All we're asking of the administration is that they enforce their own policies and make sure that Jewish students feel like they can walk through the gates to campus every day and feel welcome and have equal rights to free speech.
That's Charlotte Aaron, a Jewish student organizer at UC Berkeley, speaking to reporters yesterday. Nearly 200 students and supporters gathered on campus to protest the school's handling of anti-Semitism and discrimination. We'll look at how the Israel-Hamas war is affecting that community later in the show. First, though, L.A. Mayor Karen Bass spent this past weekend in Paris as part of an Olympic delegation ahead of the 2024 Parisian Games. The delegation hoped to learn from the French about how to prepare. With our own Olympic Games just 4 years away, Bass and other local city officials want to get people who are living on the streets in L.A. into housing before the eyes of the world are upon us. I spoke with Mayor Bass yesterday. Mayor Karen Bass, welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Great to have you back. You just returned from Paris, and while you were there, I understand you toured a shelter for unhoused women, and you met with groups to help distribute clothes and supplies to unhoused women. What did you learn about how Paris is responding to homelessness that you want to apply here ahead of our own Olympics in 4 years?
Well, you know, the big thing is for us to be forward thinking. I mean, we have massive street homelessness, something that doesn't exist in Paris. Of course, they have street homelessness, but not to the magnitude in which we do. And so we have 4 years. We have 4 years to seriously address this. And so in terms of thinking about where we need to go, you know, we need to come up with a much more efficient way of long-term interim housing while housing is getting built. And so I think the most important thing was to really make sure that the services that we provide people are strong so they don't fall in and out of homelessness. And in France, of course, they have a much better system because their social safety net is much stronger than ours is. And unfortunately, one of the reasons we have the problems we do now is because over the years we have shredded a lot of the safety net. And people always think of mental health, but it's much more than mental health that lead to people going in and out of homelessness.
Absolutely. So Paris, for a comparison, has about 4,200 homeless people, and LA City has about 46,000. So that is a huge difference.
That's right. And the population of Paris is 2.1 million. Our population is 3.8. So absolutely. Now, you know, the other thing that we're dealing with here is that it's nice to say it's 46,000. We know that is the city, but the Olympics is the county in the sense that there's a lot of other cities involved in the Olympics. And if you look at homelessness in the county, you're talking about 70,000 people. So what is going to be critically important, and I certainly saw this in Paris, is to work in collaboration. So one of the things I learned is that the Olympics is not just taking place in Paris Central, but it's also taking place in adjoining cities. And one of the cities where the Olympics is taking place is basically their inner city neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So what they did, it was very innovative. We're not going to do, but they built housing for their Olympic village that when the Olympics is over, that housing will be turned over to the community and one of the lower income communities. For us, our housing is going to be UCLA. So fortunately, one of the reasons why Mayor Garcetti was able to secure the Olympics is because we don't need to do a tremendous amount of building. That's why what I am hopeful for is that the LA Olympics will help be a catalyst to LA finally addressing homelessness in a way that is long-term, that eventually ends street homelessness.
Right. There has been criticism, even though Paris has a relatively small number of unhoused people, that they are actually busing people to other parts of the country ahead of the Olympics.
I didn't find that. I mean, you know, we have a lot of rumors about what's going on here, too. And I didn't see any evidence, any indication of that. But I know that that's, you know, the case. It's just like here, a lot of people believe that the homeless population comes from outside of L.A. and they come from Chicago and colder climates. And that's just not accurate either.
Right. So, well, this was a CNN report from last fall that reported that. But do you, you know, what can you say to allay some suspicion here that L.A. won't do that or won't consider doing that?
Well, you know, number one, you will obviously have a very major commitment for me. I don't want to do that here. I don't want to do that now. I mean, some people believe that the way to deal with homelessness is to just scatter people or make them go away. And, you know, what I've been trying to do is approaching it like we have a natural disaster, like it is an emergency, which means we need to get people off the street today. And that's how I've been approaching it, because I literally believe that having tens of thousands of people sleeping on our streets. I mean, how did it come to this, where we have allowed this to happen? And I'm not saying that from the point of view of wanting to be punitive toward anybody that's on the street, but how is it that we allow Angelenos to live and die on the streets? You know, 3 to 5 people die every single day. And I just think that's egregious, and it's something that should be unacceptable. And unfortunately, to younger Angelenos, they've known this their whole life. And I don't know about you, but I've been around for a while.
Yeah, me too.
And L.A. was not always like this.
Right. I was born here, so I know.
Well, I don't think we should accept it. And I think hopefully the Olympics will be a positive catalyst for us saying we're not going to deal with this anymore. We are going to help people get them off the street and provide enough services so they don't fall back into homelessness. And we're not doing that to what I believe is the standard that it should be right now.
Do you feel like you're getting enough support from the White House and the federal government in general? I mean, if this is a like a natural disaster, like an earthquake or a hurricane, you know, you have FEMA coming in and building temporary housing for victims who have lost their housing. You have a big national federal response. Do you feel like you're getting that?
So, you know, it's an interesting question. And now I've started to play a national role as well. I was selected to chair the National Task Force on Homelessness with the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And in April, we're bringing a group of mayors to D.C. to lobby for some very specific pieces of legislation that I can mention in a minute. I've been extremely pleased that the Biden administration has selected L.A. to be one of 5 cities that they are targeting. And I do think that the administration has done as much as they could. But when it comes to the disaster, even if Governor Newsom, who's the only person who can declare a disaster that unlocks federal support, based on how FEMA defines disaster, this situation doesn't qualify. I do believe, though, that the Biden administration has done everything they can. For example, with veteran homelessness, do you know that veterans literally a lot of times have to make a choice between accepting their benefits or accepting housing? Now, I believe that anybody that has put their life at risk for this country should have their benefits and housing. So that's top on our list in terms of the mayors that go back there. So we're going back to lobby specifically on that. And then there's 2 other items, but veterans is number one on our list.
On Friday, the city controller, Kenneth Mejia, announced a what he calls focused audit of your signature Inside Safe program, which is moving people from tents into motels and hotels temporarily for now. And this is in response to a federal judge saying he wants an audit of the whole thing, all the homeless spending programs the city is involved in. What is your response to Mejia's announcement of this audit?
Well, actually, I am going to be in communication with him this week. We've been texting each other so that we can sit down and talk about it. You know, transparency is something I have never had a problem with from day one. We've released hundreds of pages of documents about everything that we're doing. And you may or may not know, I don't know if you participated in this, but I think representatives from your station have. I have on several occasions done in-depth reporting with journalists. 90-minute reporting of where we go through everything that has been happening, including the costs. And I will tell you right now, no shock, this has been very, very expensive because we're getting people off the street. We're putting them in motels. And one of the things I've been saying all year is that we have to come up with a more cost-effective way of interim housing. Now, what I started a year ago thinking that interim was going to be much shorter, well, experience has showed me that interim is going to be a year to a year and a half, because you probably know that after declaring a state of emergency, after starting Inside Safe, I also have expedited building. So we have thousands of units that are coming online quickly, where developers used to spend 6 months, we're getting finished in 37 days. So we have over 10,000 units that are going to be coming online. But even if you fast track something, it still takes months and months. And the expense of being in a motel versus the expense of being in some other type of housing is where we need to move to. And so one thing about the market that is positive is that builders and architects are now coming up with more cost-effective ways of building interim housing that we could put up quicker than we would permanent housing. And so that's what we have to do, because the model we're using now is in response to an emergency, but it's far too expensive.
How much is it for interim?
For interim, actually, it's several thousand dollars a month in a motel room. But we are also providing services and meals, and that's what we have to figure out. Now, I've also been very concerned that the services are not to the quality that I think they should be. So when we from the city, when we move someone from a tent to a motel, then we establish a contract with a community-based organization to manage that motel. They take care of the people that are there. They provide for services. They provide for meals. And the community-based organizations we work with have been doing everything they can. But because we've increased the volume so much, they're stressed way beyond their capacity. So what I hope to do this year is to really set some basic standards for what services should be. And so in that regard, I've hired a medical physician, a medical doctor, to come on board and design services based on existing resources to establish some standards. So we've been building the plane while flying. And what I could have done, but I didn't think it was the right thing to do, I could have spent the first 4 or 5 months figuring out what's the best program in the world to do. Mm-hmm. But I just jumped into it, because to me, that is the way you respond to a natural disaster. And I could spend the rest of the day telling you about all of the problems and all of the deficiencies that we face. But I think it's critically important to stop people from dying on our streets.
So you have 256 people moved into permanent housing last year. That's correct?
That's right. I was hoping it was going to be far more than that. One of the reasons for that is because, number one, the permanent housing that's coming online has been coming online, but not to the volume in which we need it to be. Uh-huh. But there are also other interim housing. There's tiny homes. There's a bridge home. So the 200 plus people came in through Insight Safe, but I think it was more like 3,000 that came in through other areas, meaning other types of interim housing. Now, I was hoping, again, it was going to be far more than that.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody was. Well, let's hope it ramps up and ramps up quickly. And let me turn to Measure HLA, which voters overwhelmingly passed last week here in Los Angeles, which makes room on our streets for bikes and buses. And, you know, we've had Vision Zero, we've had a mobility plan, and these were all ideas to redesign our streets to make them safer. And, you know, by all accounts, that hasn't really worked. There were, more than 300 fatalities last year. Involving more than half involving pedestrians. Mm-hmm. So how will you make sure that HLA will be carried through, will be enforced, and our streets will actually be markedly safer?
Well, let me just tell you that my office is actually, since the election just happened, my office is beginning meetings today with key departments to coordinate the implementation of Measure HLA. And I will tell you that the city had in place a mobility plan, but it was taking an awful long time to get in place, which I'm sure was one of the impetus for HLA. Mm-hmm. So we have to have a long-term plan to deliver the projects in the public right away. But I will say something else to you, too, because unfortunately, it seems like all roads go back to homelessness. I get notified every time there's a fatality on the street. And I will tell you that in many of those cases, these are people that are unhoused. I'm not saying all, but we have to address that as well. People who are mentally not able to take care of themselves, wandering in the street in the middle of the night. Yeah. So we need to do much, much, much better. And I am hoping that HLA will be helpful to us to do that. And so we're starting to work on it today. But I'll be happy to keep you posted when we resolve how we're going to go about the implementation of the initiative.
Well, you raised the issue of mental illness in San Francisco. Voters there passed a measure that would require people who receive welfare benefits who are experiencing mental illness to be treated or lose their benefits. Is that something that you would support doing in L.A.?
I would much rather move to implementation of the care court. Now, you know, I have a medical background and I've worked in the emergency room. I've even worked in the psychiatric emergency room. So I'm somebody that strongly supports that it is inhumane to leave people that you clearly know have no idea that they're ill. They are so ill that they do not know that they're ill. And I think to just leave them on the streets is inhumane. Sometimes people need to be hospitalized against their will, and it doesn't mean that they're hospitalized forever, but you know what we do now. We operate the nation's most expensive mental health institution, and that's the county jail. So I would rather hospitalize somebody against their will for a couple of months, stabilize them, and then put them in housing. That's not what we currently do. We currently allow people to deteriorate on our streets until they become violent, and then we incarcerate them. And I don't know, and you want to talk about money, it costs way more to incarcerate somebody than it does to take care of them.
Well, Mayor Karen Bass, thank you so much for spending the time. And thank you. Thank you very much. And good luck with the Olympics planning.
Sure. We'll keep you posted.
And after we taped that interview, Mayor Bass's office clarified a couple of figures she gave. They say the current number of people who have gotten permanent housing through Inside Safe is actually 329 and not 256. And also to clarify something I said, the new San Francisco ballot initiative I mentioned mandates drug testing and treatment for welfare recipients and does not apply to all mental health disorders. Coming up, Disneyland is about to embark on a $2 billion expansion. Why not everyone is happy about that? And the increasing tensions over Israel at UC Berkeley. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Maybe it's not such a small world after all. Disneyland is one step closer to expanding. The Anaheim Planning Commission approved the company's plan to spend nearly $2 billion to transform the theme park over the next decade. New mixed-use developments with shopping, dining, possibly new attractions. It might be more fun for visitors, but not everyone in Orange County is happy with the happiest place on earth these days. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist with the LA Times who is based in the OC. Hello.
Hola, Madeline.
All right. This was a 5-1 vote, so it seemed almost unanimous from the Planning Commission that they wanted this to happen. What exactly did they vote on?
So they're basically saying that they agree with Disneyland that they're going to change the zoning for the area around Disneyland. So just to backtrack, obviously Disneyland was created in Anaheim in the late 1950s. Walt Disney bought a whole bunch of property, but what he realized quickly was that he didn't buy enough property. So he has been the company has been hamstrung by what they could do because they're in the middle of a city of 300 and some thousand, maybe 400 some thousand residents, my hometown. And all that, and what Anaheim has tried to do for them is like say, like, look, you could only develop around your area. You can't do much more. So what's proposed then is that the current lots that Disneyland has, so it's mostly parking lots, that they're going to be able to expand on them. They also want to buy a street outright, a small city-owned street from Anaheim, because they really want to replicate what they have in Orlando out here in OC.
All right. So what is the problem with that? What's the controversy?
Well, do I want to be opinionated or do I want to give facts? I'll start with the facts and I'll give my opinion.
Okay.
People are saying, number one, that if the city sells off its own streets, it's going to cut off a vital artery that allows people to circumvent the traffic that Disneyland already has. So Magic Way, it's on the western side of Disneyland. There's but really just passes through Disney property. There's another one closer to the 5 freeway. And not only that, though, city critics have been rightfully pointing out that Disneyland has a lot of power in the city. Do we really want to give whatever Disneyland wants to them without trying to get some things out of them? And Disneyland, of course, is saying, well, you know, we're gonna have thousands of union jobs at first for the construction. Then there's going to be thousands of union jobs afterwards for the people actually working at the parks. But the critics of Anaheim rightfully say, can we really trust the city government whose mayor recently pled guilty to corruption and who the FBI has been looking at for years on end? Now, nothing has been alleged with Disney itself ever doing any wrongdoing on that sense. But as my colleagues at the LA Times have reported, they do have way too much influence in the city. Me personally, I don't think it's smart to base your entire economy on one company, even if it is Mickey Mouse and Grogu.
Right. So they make up, what, more than half of Anaheim's tax base? So,
and not just Disneyland, but also the convention center, also the Ducks. Basically, Anaheim has turned into a tourist town. My hometown, where, you know, I went to school, my family's still there, I still have a P.O. box. More and more, I have seen factories shut down, places that gave you good blue-collar jobs shut down, all because the city thinks that the best way for us to keep a great city alive is by letting Disneyland and other multi-billion-dollar corporations do whatever they want.
Well, there is also some pushback when it comes to the salaries paid to many of the workers there at Disneyland. Lots of reports about how many of them have to be on food stamps or welfare benefits in order to make ends meet. So any concessions along those lines that Disneyland, in exchange for this approval to expand, would raise the salaries of its workers?
Well, Disneyland is saying, hey, look, we're going to give millions of dollars for Anaheim so they could build affordable housing, most likely for our own workers. And one of the executives of Disneyland during this meeting said, every single job is union. That's the sad irony of these low-paying jobs at Disneyland. A lot of the jobs at Disneyland, I still don't think people know enough about this. They're union jobs. The hotel workers, represented by Unite Here Local 11. There's, the cast members, most of them are union. But what good is a union job if it can't afford you to be able to live, you know, to buy your own house in Orange County or even to be able to afford the apartment? That's what the unions have been very upset about. It's like, yeah, we like our contracts, but pay us more than a living wage. And Unite Here Local 11, they actually try to pass a measure in Anaheim through the voters that would have put the minimum wage in what's called the resort district. In other words, where Disneyland and a lot of hotels, either owned by Disneyland or not, are, they would have to pay them a minimum of $25 an hour. And Disneyland, a lot of hotel owners, they pushed back and successfully. So you're going to bring more jobs here, but what kind of jobs? And is it really worth it in exchange for all these concessions? And also, the own environmental impact reports created for the Anaheim Planning Commission say, oh yeah, by the way, the quality of air is going to go even worse. But, oh, well, it's cool, I guess.
Well, I guess that happens with any big construction, right? There's going to be just a lot of stuff thrown into the air when you build something that massive, right? I mean, it sort of goes with the cost of doing business.
That's the best way to put it. Stuff thrown in the air. And by the way, you already have fireworks 365 days out of the year. Remember, Disneyland is right next to apartment complexes and neighborhoods. So, yeah, all that stuff in the air has to be breathed by someone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what is your sense? Do most residents in Anaheim not really like the Mouse House down there, or do they support it? Do they like it? Like, what's the general feeling?
Oh, everyone loves Disneyland. Come on. How can you not like Donald Duck and Zootopia and Elsa from Frozen and all of that? I mean, the only people who really push back against Disneyland's attempts to expand are longtime community activists, and they're, by the way, I think they, what they say is absolutely true. You know, sometimes the hotel workers as well, or, you know, the union workers at Disneyland, they want a job. They just want it to be paid higher. But most folks, for the most part, Disneyland, you only are reminded of it if you have to drive down Harbor Boulevard and deal with all the traffic, or you're coming off the 5 freeway trying to get off on Ball Road and there's a lot of traffic, or again, the fireworks. For the most part, people don't care. For the most part, people love to go to Disneyland. Full disclosure, I have relatives who go to Disneyland, or not just relatives who go to Disneyland, but who work at Disneyland, and they love it. And of course, I personally, I'm looking at a 1930s statue of Donald Duck when he was bigger and fatter. I love Donald Duck as well, but I don't like Disneyland.
Do you go there?
I have not been there like in 7 years. No reason to.
All right. Gustavo Arellano, columnist with the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Gracias.
Tomorrow on Press Play, we're all kind of freaking out over AI, but how can we use it for good? We'll assess the various chatbots out there and how to use them. That's tomorrow on the show. Coming up today, the tensions on the UC Berkeley campus over the Israel-Hamas war.
The chancellor actually invited the group to speak with them yesterday. They said, you know, we really want to talk about divestment, and if that's not on the table... They said, we don't have anything we can tell you that you don't already know.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Yesterday, about 200 students and Jewish community members gathered at UC Berkeley to protest anti-Semitism on campus. After an incident in late February where pro-Palestinian protesters demonstrated outside a lecture hall where a former member of the Israeli military was speaking, they broke a glass door, people were forced to flee, and the speech was canceled.
When we see the kind of despicable violence that we saw here on campus just a few days ago, it is totally and completely unacceptable.
That's Berkeley City Council member Sophie Hahn speaking at that rally yesterday. Sydney Johnson is a reporter covering this for KQED. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, describe the scene there and the protest. Who was there and what were they saying?
So I arrived yesterday in the morning. There were folks gathering for the march. Everyone was wearing white around about 11. There was a bagel brunch. Folks were kind of just gathering. And after having some breakfast, the crowd kind of started to get a little bit larger. And then there were a few speakers, including one faculty member at UC Berkeley also. And then the group, which at its peak we estimated to be around 180 or 200 folks, did a silent march down Sproul Plaza, which is kind of the main thoroughfare that enters the campus. It's where a lot of the free speech movement activity is kind of historically placed. And so the group marched through there. And what they came across was a nonviolent protest that has been going on for almost 5 weeks now, right in front of Seder Gate. And Seder Gate is this iconic green gate right at the front of campus where students will pass through after going through tables of clubs and, you know, things like that. And then it kind of opens up to the actual campus. I should say, I actually am a Cal alum. I'm very familiar with this area and you know, protests that took place here are very common.
So for 5 weeks or so, this pro-Palestinian organization group has been protesting in front of Souther Gate. They've erected yellow police tape and signs. Has that been a focal point for these two sides, a point of disagreement?
Yes. So that was a main focal point of the organizers of the march yesterday. They said that Jewish students have been targeted and harassed when they have tried to walk through. They've said that students have had to walk around the gate, which on the sides. There's a little creek, and some students said that they've had to walk through the creek in order to get to class. Yesterday, the sign did not block the thoroughfare. There are two clear walkways that students were passing through. And we reached out to the university also to ask about some of these rules around, you know, can they have a sign like this? Have they been breaking any of these policies? And the university did clarify and confirm to us that at no point during this protest over the last 5 weeks has the sign fully blocked the thoroughfare. So I think that's just important to note. Like, the gate was blocked. There is a huge sign, but it wasn't fully blocked. There are two clear pathways on both sides. That said, there were still plenty of students who said that even walking through those walkways was hostile and that they didn't feel safe doing so.
So this has been going on for a while, ever since the Hamas attack on October 7th, right? Shortly thereafter, right. There were protests. And the dean of Berkeley Law, Erwin Chemerinsky, actually wrote an op-ed here in the LA Times saying he has never seen or felt the kind of anti-Semitism he has seen in the last few weeks. And he wrote that on October 29th. So can you just talk about what's been happening on campus? I know UC Berkeley has a long history of protest. And so what is the tenor on campus? What has it been like in the past, I don't know, 5 months?
Yeah, you know, it from folks that I've talked to, it sounds like tensions are pretty high, and the university is aware of this as well. They agreed that it seems like it's a really tense time for students and faculty. You know, I think we saw that really reach a tipping point with the speaker last week, and just how there were, I think there were close to 200 students who blocked those gates. And some of the stories that we heard coming out of that yesterday were serious and probably pretty frightening for students that were there. At the same time, we heard from students who disagreed with that speaker's ideas that he was coming to campus with, and, you know, felt that it was their right to protest the speaker. But of course, the way that event spiraled was not within any type of permitted protest policy that the university would have.
And I understand the Department of Education is investigating Berkeley. Berkeley's on a list of campuses, including Stanford, UCSD, even Santa Monica College, for possible discrimination. They didn't say what kind of discrimination, but they are investigating. So this has been elevated to a federal matter.
That's right. So Berkeley has simultaneously started an investigation of its own into the protest around the speaker last week, kind of what went down. And then at the same time, the federal U.S. Department of Education has launched an inquiry into Berkeley looking at discrimination. So far, there hasn't been a clear tie as to whether last week's events prompted UC Berkeley to be added to that investigation. But, you know, it seems like that could potentially be related. But like you said, they haven't said exactly what kind of ancestry and really what will be looked at in the investigation. We're still waiting to find out.
So the Jewish students are saying that they feel unsafe. What about the pro-Palestinian students?
Yeah, the pro-Palestinian students that I spoke to who were holding the banner said that they have received harassment every day just by standing there and holding that sign. I actually witnessed some of this. There was a man who was not a student who rode up on a bike and started calling them terrorists. Someone said that that's been happening every single day. So this group has been really focusing on trying to get the university to divest from Israel. That is sort of one of their big goals, and they have been trying to meet with university officials in order to have some serious conversations about that. The chancellor actually invited the group to speak with them yesterday, the same day as his planned march, and the group declined. They said, you know, we really want to talk about divestment, and if that's not on the table, they said, we don't have anything we can tell you that you don't already know, was what I was shared. In general, what I heard was just that the university has reported that there have been dozens of discrimination complaints from students of both Jewish and Muslim communities. They didn't exactly say how many or, you know, which group has been experiencing more or reporting more, but they did say that there have been at least dozens in the last few weeks from people of a variety of different backgrounds.
Sydney Johnson is a reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Sydney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the black character on Peanuts, Franklin, gets his own movie on Apple TV Plus. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, which means it's time for TV on the radio.
This your beach ball? That thing sure has a mind of its own. Thank you for catching it.
You're welcome. I'm Franklin. Franklin Armstrong.
My name is Charlie Brown. Thanks again.
It has been half a century since the black character Franklin was introduced to Charlie Brown and the Peanuts gang. The Peanuts specials were a favorite when many of us were kids, and they still are a holiday tradition for lots of us. But in recent years, one of the specials, A Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, has become the subject of much internet criticism. In one of the final scenes at dinner, all the white children sit on one side of the table, while Franklin sits all alone on the other side. And to make matters worse, he has to sit in a lawn chair. Well, the Schultz family decided to right that wrong in their latest movie. It's called Snoopy Presents Welcome Home Franklin. It's Franklin's origin story, how he moved to town, struggled to fit in, and made friends with a boy named Charlie Brown.
Hey, Franklin, what kind of music do you like?
My favorites are Stevie Wonder, Little Richard, and, of course, the godfather of soul, James Brown. You're not related, are you?
I don't believe so.
Snoopy Presents Welcome Home Franklin is currently streaming on Apple TV Plus, and joining us now is Adrian Sebro, professor of media studies at the University of Texas at Austin, where he focuses on black pop culture. Hello.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so what do you make of the controversy over the seating arrangements at this Thanksgiving special with Franklin on one side and all the other kids on the other side?
Yeah, it's been a huge thing over the past recent years in the time of social media, sharing memes and GIFs. It's been one that's kind of been circulated around the holidays, but also as a point to make surrounding such a beloved show as Charlie Brown, some of the kind of coded messaging in it. So to hear that this new Franklin origin story was coming out, you know, a lot of folks saw that as kind of an answer to or a response to a kind of a right finally being a wrong finally being righted. I think it was hugely important to a lot of members of popular culture in the black community specifically to kind of see this inclusion of Franklin as a character, because so often we see in popular culture these kind of token black characters pushed to the side. And to see Franklin have some depth that's offered for the first time was very inspiring.
Was there any explanation ever given for why he was put in a lawn chair and off to the side?
No, I haven't read any explanation in researching of the show and from watching it. But those things are, you know, it's hard to think that it was simple mishap or, you know, wasn't strategic in some way, because it's a clear way of, you know, why not any other character, right? And it clearly points out to why this specific character is kind of placed on the outside. And I think it speaks larger to kind of a history of the Peanuts, of who works in comic books, and really race in the comic book and animation industry. And again, you know, it's hard to deem any malicious intent, but, you know, these can be moments of, you know, reflection of, you know, probably inherent biases that may have taken place, whereas you would see Franklin as kind of an outside member of this community or of this friend group, whereas he's a part of it. And this new film is actually kind of making that clear.
Well, let's go back in time, way back to the 1960s, and the reason a black character was introduced in the first place. A white school teacher whose name was Harriet Glickman wrote to Charles Schultz and suggested that he create this character. And here she is telling her story for the Charles M. Schultz Museum.
That letter was the result of my whole life. It was seeing racism in this country, knowing that no matter what, there was ugliness and violence was after the assassination of Martin Luther King and the frustration and the anger, I said to my children, this is a lesson. One person can make a difference. It's a very little difference, not earth-shaking, but it's a difference.
And this is what led to Charles Schulz creating Franklin?
Yes, it is. So 1968 was a great watershed year in American social politics. Particularly what happened is the reason that the teacher, Harry Glickman, actually suggested it was about, I think, 10 or so days after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And 1968 also led to the assassination of a lot of civil rights leaders and even Robert F. Kennedy as well, too. And it became this year that's kind of known in infamy as a Reconstruction year. A great leader being lost, a lot of television programs, especially public affairs television shows coming to rise. Julia, that's this kind of first Black sitcom, the star of women since the 1950s. So 1968 was this year of holding accountable these television programs, or in this case, this comic book and later show, holding them accountable to creating a world that exists that we see in real life. Very similar to, you know, Stan Lee and Marvel, where the Black Panther character came about in 1966, mm-hmm. the Black Panther Party. So these moments in the 60s made artists realize how important it is to speak about the cultural moment. And with that is having characters that reflect reality. And thankful to Harry Glickman for realizing that there was a space to be filled. And I'm thankful for this new show to actually give more depth to this space that hadn't been filled in 1968.
I want to play another clip, and this is from Robin Reed, and as the voice actor who played Franklin in the Thanksgiving special, talking about the pushback that Charles Schulz received when Franklin was first introduced.
There was a point when Franklin was introduced into the comic strip that someone in the South, one of the places where his strip was syndicated, said he didn't want it in there. And Charles Schulz said, you know, that's fine. If you're not going to do it, then I will pull my comic strip and you won't have it in your market. And obviously he won that particular argument.
That's Robin Reed, the voice of Franklin, talking to MSNBC in 2021. And so was there a lot of pushback when Franklin first appeared?
Yeah, and much of the pushback came about, like, there was this trying to figure out a way to introduce him, right? And to the point that they wanted to feel like it wasn't a tokenism in any way, but the introduction of him was very different. So in watching the film, he's introduced as someone who's moving into town, meeting this new young boy, being Charlie Brown at the beach. And so, like, you actually see a lot of those things happen in the film that were actually...
The new film. Yeah.
Yes, in the new film that were actually about, like, how Franklin was first introduced. In the comic strip. So some things like relay over time. But what changes is, you know, at first he's introduced as someone who is who goes to a different school, he is random chance meeting. So they kind of bring these things together to make a reality out of it. But in regards to the Thanksgiving film, you know, this placing of characters, this acknowledgement of Franklin as part of the family largely wasn't there. And I think that this recent film that just came out puts Franklin into the lexicon of what Charlie Brown is all about without it feeling any more like a side character or side gag or simply a number meant to appease certain folks. But I think in the beginning of the publication of Franklin, it was a matter of, you know, simply kind of appeasing to the masses who may have had an issue with the show. But Southern editors of the show, as was talked about as well, had issue with the Franklin character. They felt that, you know, there's no place for him in this already created world of Charlie Brown. But thankfully for Schulz, he continued to press back at that and kept Franklin character in there. There could have been more development, in my opinion, but I think having the character in there was a sign of positive things in the direction.
Yeah. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Adrian Sebro. He's a professor of media studies at the University of Texas at Austin, where he focuses on Black pop culture. And we're talking about a new show on Apple TV Plus called Snoopy Presents Welcome Home Franklin, which tells the origin story of the Black character in the Peanuts cartoon named Franklin. Do you think that there is adequate representation in animation?
Yeah, I mean, I think now that there's so much, and I think that, you know, even like not even counting like Disney and their films, but so many popular television shows like a Doc McStuffins or other TV shows that prominently feature young Black kids who are, you know, perform as doctors or who can kind of live in these imaginary and created worlds. And I think too, and even when you think of animation, we think of like even like kind of the adult animation, you know, and how we see in shows like Boondocks, for instance, why it's very much of an adult show and like kind of this late night Cartoon Network show, but is about a Black family and in space of animation. So animation has become this space of really, it's fantasy. So how you play around with race, identity, human beings, all these things, right? It makes clear that the animation world is kind of meant for this idea of the other, this idea for the unexpected, this idea of things that are simply only imagined, unimaginable. So really when it came to introducing Blackness to animation, it was actually much easier than we think of like reality, like television shows or films, because animation sells in this idea of, you know, as a relief from the reality, as an escape. So Now we see Blackness in these various ways on animation, and it doesn't really seem like new anymore or something kind of different. But it's in that way, I think it's appreciated. And I think that when it becomes norm, that's when things are in the right direction. And with the case of Franklin, I think it was simply, you know, Charlie Brown doesn't spark a lot of the current adolescents, you know, part of their lexicon of animation. This film was definitely for nostalgia purposes, for the folks who grew through and with Charlie Brown. And this show was, I think, meant as an homage to bring us back to watching this and to bring us back to a story of an individual who has probably gotten the most attention from the show in recent years. And a world can be built around them, honestly, quite easily. In this 45-minute film, they built a believable world around this character. And I don't see that happening with any other character on the show, but particularly Franklin had a very fruitful space to be able to kind of cultivate how this character can be built. So I think this moment was actually perfect for it.
You know, just watching the show, it seems like Franklin is the most well-adjusted of all of them. Like, they're right. All a bunch of weirdos,
yeah. You
know, with their problems, you know, like Linus and his blanket and Pigpen, and Charlie Brown is, you know, a loser and doesn't have friends, and Lucy is, I don't know, she's a little bit too old for her age and runs a psychiatrics stand instead of a lemonade stand. So I don't know, like, how does Franklin fit into this world if he's so well adjusted?
I love the way they wrote this character, because Franklin's biggest and largest issue was trying to find friends, you know? So we get this history that his, you know, father was in the war, or his father was in the military service. So he's bounced around his entire life, right? And his biggest thing was not being able to sit in one place or ever build friends. That was his biggest conflict. Everything else is extremely well adjusted. He knows the music he likes. He knows the sports he likes. He's witty. He's quick. He has style, you know, he loves jazz music. What child loves jazz, right? So this kind of old soul that he has, and like he learns how to make friends from, you know, messages that his grandpa left him, right? So yeah, the adjustment is great, but he doesn't know how to interact with other kids because he's always on the move. So for him, these other kids, they seem normal in their own environments, but to him, you know, he's just trying to make himself feel normal, but he tries so hard and it pushes people away. So it's like this endearing thing about him is he's just someone who wants to be liked. Charlie Brown, as the main character, as the namesake of the show or in comic strip, he is known as like this kind of loser kind of character. People make fun of him a lot often. So the perfect match for Franklin, really, like, who is the outsider that I can feel like I'm just as cool with or cooler than, but also he'll accept me for my awkwardness. And so the character and how they developed him and how these nuances of Black history that he knows and he's equipped with beyond his years was fascinating to me, but still felt very real as far as like a kid who's raised to like enjoy precious music and art and sports. And that goes a lot to his traveling and him trying to grasp at and learn things so much because everything else in his life is in flux.
He finally gets a seat at the table, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess you could say that. Well, thank you so much for talking about this. That was really interesting.
Oh, yeah, of course. I'm glad to talk about it. I'm happy to see Franklin get this post. And they actually even brought a chair out for him and said, hey, we saved the seat for you.
Hey, Franklin, We saved you a seat over here. Come join us. Ain't that what friendship's really all about?
It was a perfect kind of closing bookend moment to a history that everyone was waiting to happen.
Aw, yeah, that was a great moment in the new show. Adrian Seabrough, professor of media studies at the University of Texas at Austin. We've been talking about Snoopy Presents Welcome Home Franklin, currently streaming on Apple TV+. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you back here again tomorrow.